Welcome back to the program. It's fair to say that it hasn't been a good decade. Since the dawn of the 21st century, almost all of our ideas of community, culture, perhaps even our notions of what constitutes a country, not to mention how we communicate, do business, read, think, and see, are being transformed and in many cases cascading in upon us. But why? The biologist and philosopher E.O. Wilson years ago coined the term consonance. Wilson believed that a balanced perspective couldn't be achieved by studying disciplines or problems in pieces, but through the pursuit of a consonance among them. He had the dream that everything would fit together into a single overarching vision. Our guest today, Chris Hayes, has done exactly that in his new book, Twilight of the Elites. He connects the dots among seemingly disparate events of the past decade and finds the common threads that includes, among many others, the Tea Party, baseball, the Catholic Church, and Washington. Chris Hayes is editor-at-large for The Nation magazine. He's host of Up with Chris Hayes, which is on Saturday and Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. on MSNBC. He's a fellow at Harvard University's Edmund Safra Foundation, and his work has appeared in numerous other publications. It is my pleasure to welcome Chris Hayes here to talk about his new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. Chris Hayes, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for the kind introduction.
Great to have you here. One of the things you talk about is this crisis of authority that exists as a result of so many of the failures of the past decade, and certainly the litany of those failures is a long one and an impressive one. Yet if we look back at other times, and even in contemporary history, we see things like Vietnam, Watergate, Kent State, Iran-Contra. I mean, we can go through a whole list. What's different this time?
It's a good question. I mean, first, I think crises of authority happen routinely in societies. And one of the ironies of what's happening right now is, you know, the polling that I rely on in the first chapter to establish this just basic fact about public opinion, which is that our trust in our pillar institutions is at an all-time low. The irony of that is the polling that I'm relying on began in the early 1970s, 1972, 1973, in the wake of Watergate, when the dominant conversation was about the nation going through a crisis of authority in the wake of Vietnam and Watergate. And they started asking people, how much confidence, how much trust do you have in these institutions, and giving them a list, you know, the news media, newspapers, the presidency, medicine, etc. And the irony is that that period of time, which at the time we think of as a low watermark, was actually the high watermark for trust in institutions. And right now, the last decade, we're living through the lowest point. So what at the time I think people saw as this debilitating crisis of authority and was as discussed as such, in the rearview mirror actually looks like very high levels of trust and confidence in the pillar institutions. And what we have right now is quite a bit lower than that. So I think one of the points of the book, the kind of starting place of the inquiry, is just to talk about this crisis of authority as a dominant feature of contemporary public life, and one of the things that structures it. And I don't think we have that same conversation about it that they did, say, in the late 1960s, early 70s.
Right. How much of that crisis of authority at this point, though, and the fact that the numbers are so much lower and that the crisis seems so much larger, is as a result of the changes in other institutions within our society, the media in part, technology in part, that the conversation is happening in different ways, that the perception is different?
That's a great, great question. I mean, I think there are people who will say that the problem is that you have a media environment that just stokes distrust almost pathologically. And, you know, there are folks like, you know, I interviewed Bob Bennett, who was a senator from Utah for years until he was unceremoniously dumped out by a Tea Party insurgency in the state's GOP convention. And, you know, he basically says to me in the book, look, if people read responsible publications, you know, the Washington Post editorial page, then we're fine. But if they're reading these blogs and all we're doing is lying to you. And I think there is a kernel of truth to the idea that the changes in the modern media environment are part of what has precipitated the distrust. That said, I think it's really important to take a step back and look at the last decade of institutional performance, which has been terrible. I mean, it's the longest period of war in the history of the nation, combined with the worst financial crisis and destruction of wealth and the Great Recession, and in the middle, a major American city drowning on television while everybody watched, 1,000 dead. Those are just three of the biggest lowlights. Mm-hmm. You can go on and on. I actually think that the kind of Occam's razor explanation for why people have so little trust is that the actual institutional performance and elite performance has been quite poor. and institutions have shown themselves to be untrustworthy, and so people don't trust them.
And in fact, that is what seems to be different this time, that the level of incompetence among the elites, among the people running those institutions, both in the public and private sector, the level of incompetence seems to be greater.
Yeah, I think that's right. Although, I mean, you know, Vietnam was pretty terrible, so I shouldn't, you know, underestimate it. But yeah, I mean, part of it is also the stakes are larger. I mean, when you look at the financial crisis, particularly, I mean, what's so striking about the financial crisis is there is a relatively small number of people who understood the machine that was constructed to channel dodgy loans, subprime loans, no doc loans into securities that were then sold off. The number of people that really were on the inside of that machine is maybe numbers in the hundreds, maybe at the top of thousands, right? People that really understood what was happening were really moving that. And when you think about how much havoc they were able to wreak, it's really quite remarkable. And I think that's part of what, you know, the nature of the scale and scope of our current institutional landscape and the power, particularly in finance, that a relatively small amount of people have is kind of terrifying, because when they screw it up, the stakes are very high and the damage is massive.
And this goes to the other key point of your book, which is this growing gap between the elites and everybody else, and the broader point that the more elite society gets, the worse the caliber of the elites who are running it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the book, you know, the book talks about inequality, but it talks about it in a way, I think, that's a little different than the way we usually talk about it, particularly, you know, people on the center left broadly who are concerned with inequality, which is that we tend to talk about inequality in terms of why it's bad and how it's bad for the folks at the bottom of the social hierarchy, you know, the working class and the poor and the middle class who are seeing their wages stagnate. And I think all those arguments are important and right, but the argument I'm making is actually an argument about how perhaps the most destructive part of inequality is the fact that it produces a set of elites who cannot help but fail, who are both blinded to some important information that would allow them to make good judgments, and also incentivized to be corrupt and to cut corners because of the just tremendous payouts that are available up at the top. And that combination produces a very destructive set of actions. And that's, you know, we are prone to crisis, I think, under the current conditions because of the vast, what I call in the book, social distance, the vast social distance between those at the top and everyone else.
And the impact that it has on those on the top. And you talk about it in terms of the moral argument that Desmond Tutu, for example, presented with respect to apartheid.
Yeah, Desmond Tutu has an amazing line in his book, No Future Without Forgiveness, which is his memoir of struggle against apartheid. And he says, you know, even the people that benefited from apartheid, even the white ruling class, were degraded, were harmed by being participants in the system. And I think that's a profound insight that's true about all kinds of hierarchies and is true now in terms of the ways in which being at the top of the current system distorts the people who are there. You know, particularly the ways in which this, and we can talk about this a bit, meritocracy and the ideology of that, but the ways in which the current sort of social model that we have of elite selection combined with the intense and constant corrupting presence of a lot of money if you want to go cash out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I take some examples of that in the book, and I also write about, you know, settings. I write in the book about Major League Baseball for almost an entire chapter, and I write about it in the context of looking at an organization that really is a meritocracy in a lot of ways. I mean, it is, you know, if you're a aging slugger who can't hit the fastball, you get benched. If you're a 19-year-old Dominican kid who can't speak English and no one knows your name, but you can paint the corners with a fastball that's 98 miles an hour, then you can pitch. And, you know, there's huge rewards for performance and there's punishments for failure. And so it does everything that we kind of think we want a meritocracy to do and look like. But what it turns out in the story of baseball in the steroids era is that it's much harder than it looks to create a system with big rewards for performance that isn't also a system with big rewards for cheating. And we saw that line blur in Enron, for instance, which was a very meritocratic place, very very free-flowing place where they didn't really think about seniority. They thought about performance. They rewarded performance. They punished failure. And we saw it on Wall Street. And we see it, you know, broadly in society up at the top. You know, when you have big rewards for performance, those also are big incentives for rigging the game, for cheating, for cutting corners. And unless there's some kind of either set of institutional norms or regulation and rules, you're going to see a lot of that cheating.
And it really becomes the argument about the smartest guys in the room. And what you talk about is this kind of cult of smartness.
Yeah, the cult of smartness, I think, is a key feature here, because smartness is very key to how we conceive of the meritocracy and who rises through it. And I think there's a tendency, you know, obviously smartness is very important and valuable in people that are going to be making decisions, but it's a necessary attribute and not a sufficient one. I mean, there's other qualities that are, I think, equally valuable: prudence, judgment, wisdom, compassion, for instance. And those get cast aside because smartness is so central to the way we think about and the system we've designed to select for elites. And it leads to this cult of smartness, which isn't just a celebration of smartness, but a celebration of smartness as the key signal virtue, and also as one that's readily and identifiable and rankable. So-and-so, you know, in meetings, in this dynamic of so-and-so is smarter than so-and-so, and the ways in which who gets listened to and who doesn't correlate to perceptions of smartness, it all has to do with reducing, you know, the core idea that's driving all of this, when we have this vision of meritocracy, is merit, right? Merit is one of these ideas that's great from 30,000 feet, but if you zoom in, it starts to get a lot more complicated to try to define it and nail it down. And so what ends up happening is things get reduced to a single trait, you know, smartness, for instance, as a stand-in, or money, right? How big your bonus is a kind of quantifiable way of talking about what your merit is. And that's really problematic.
And we've created this nexus where smartness kind of represents class in the whole class debate.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what we say is that we, the model we have is that we select out the smartest folks from all backgrounds, and they, you know, are funneled through the institutions of meritocratic selection. And, we end up with the you know, to use a phrase from last generation, the best and the brightest. Mm-hmm. I think, first of all, that's manifestly not true. I mean, one of the critiques in the book is that what we call a meritocracy actually isn't that meritocratic at all. There's the George W. Bush, born on third base, thinking he hit a triple kind of thing. And I mean, you know, if we look at who is in the Senate, who is running for president, there's a whole lot of children of former politicians.
Right. What a writer friend of mine refers to as the lucky sperm club.
That's right. Exactly. So, you know, we also have that issue. And those two things, you know, what's interesting is the way those two interact, because at one level we have this kind of mythology about self-determination and achievement up by the bootstraps achievement. On the other, we have the reality of a tremendous amount of inherited privilege. And it's interesting to see the way, for instance, Mitt Romney deals with that that combination, which is that, you know, he was at a Republican primary debate a few months ago, and he basically said, look, you know, I could have inherited the car company, but I didn't. I struck out on my own, right? He goes to Harvard Law and Harvard Business School and start Bain. Basically, I earned every dollar I got. And his wife gave this great interview where she was talking about, you know, living with Mitt in dingy student housing, and she had to staple carpet samples to the floor. And when times got really tough, they had to sell some of the stock that Mitt had inherited from his father to make ends meet. And it sounds like such a ridiculous story, but it's genuinely felt, I think. And the reason it's genuinely felt is because the model of achievement we have in our society requires that you write for yourself a story of how you overcame.
Right. I mean, it's sort of punching all the right holes in the card along the way.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, in many ways, it's created a kind of oligarchy of intelligence, and oligarchies always have their inherent problems, and that's much of what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that is the argument in some ways of the book, is that what we call a meritocracy, what we set up a meritocracy, is now looking increasingly more and more like an oligarchy where privilege is passed from, you know, across generations, where a smaller group of people control a larger share of the resources and the power, in which we have declining social mobility over time. I mean, the facts are, and again, the data on this is a little blurry because it's statistically quite hard to calculate in a lot of ways, but the data really strongly suggests that we have a situation now where the odds of starting out, say, in the bottom 20% of the income distribution and working your way to the top 20% of the income distribution over your lifetime, the odds of that happening are worse now than they were 20 years ago or 40 years ago. And that suggests that the meritocracy, which is fundamentally about social mobility, about the American dream, about people with any background or station rising as far as their talents will take them, that it's not actually delivering on its central promise.
And yet at the center of this is Barack Obama, who is at the apogee of that American dream.
Yeah, this is the kind of tragic irony of Barack Obama, which is that, you know, he is the crowning glory of the system. I mean, it's only during this period of time in America and only under this model of elite formation, the meritocracy, that a man of that skin color and name and background could be president. He 40 or 50 years ago, he wouldn't have been in Harvard Law. it's really wonderful and a testament to the system that that's the case, because he's such a manifestly capable and talented individual. At the same time, you know, he inherits the system just as it's crashing down around our ears. And in some senses, I think that the times require a rethinking of that model that I think is almost impossible for someone in his position to undertake.
How does this relate to the attacks, primarily from the right, that we see on elites, the kind of anti-elitist, anti-intellectualism in many cases, attacks that we see, you know, Sarah Palin being perhaps the penultimate example, that are really focused on the elites?
Yeah, I mean, the right has appropriated the word really, really effectively. And not only did they appropriate it, it's a distortion of the traditional meaning of the word. I mean, you know, the right has used this word to mean basically people with a certain set of, you know, tastes and cultural affects and habits and patterns of life, you know, listening to NPR and driving a Prius and living in San Francisco or in Berkeley or in Seattle or in the Upper West Side and, you know, sipping Chablis or whatever silly, cliches they invoke. And that's just not the historical understanding of the word. I mean, people have been writing about elites for hundreds of years and both on the right and the left. And it's, you know, if you're a chimney sweep in 19th century London and you happen to like fox hunting and opera, it doesn't mean you're an elite. You're still a chimney sweep. And if you're Warren Buffett, who drives a beat-up old sedan and likes unpretentious American food like burgers, you know, you're still one of the most powerful men in the world when the global financial system is about to collapse. You're the one getting phone calls. So if you're not a member of elite, then no one is. The word has no meaning. So part of the project of the book is just reasserting this basic idea that the definition of elite isn't people's consumer tastes. It's, you know, it is a relatively small, in some senses, very small group of people with a disproportionate influence over society's direction.
Another overlay that you talk about with respect to all of this is this notion of this world of post-truth politics that we live in, and the way that's also continuing to erode trust. Talk about that, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, the effect of this crisis of authority are that we don't have shared sources of authority. And without shared sources of authority, it's very hard to have, it's very hard to have conversations and debates that in which everyone is kind of at the same table. The way that we come to know about the world is through trust relationships. This is, I think, a really important thing to consider. I don't actually know what's happening in Afghanistan. What I know is that there's a variety of journalistic sources that I trust that are telling me what's happening there. But fundamentally, the trust is the foundation of my knowledge. Mm-hmm. If I thought the New York Times was essentially an untrustworthy, fundamentally corrupt and deceitful institution, then I wouldn't, you know, nothing it said about what's going on in Afghanistan would reach me. And there are media outlets, obviously, I feel that way about. And so it's very hard to talk across these divides, right? People that listen to Glenn Beck, you know, they trust Glenn Beck and they don't trust the New York Times. And that's a fundamental prior that it's difficult to dislodge. And so when you have this situation, and in a lot of senses, a lot of the media have brought this on themselves. I mean, obviously the Times reporting on WMD is kind of the chief mm-hmm. example of this. But, you know, you have this situation in which we get our knowledge through this relationship of trust with either people or institutions and some form of institutional authority. And when that institutional authority becomes dislodged, you know, we're not really anchored anymore. And when we're not anchored, it seems like it's this kind of, you know, we run the danger of being in this nihilistic world of just sheer will to power as opposed to argument and persuasion.
And the New York Times, like so many other institutions we've been talking about, have become calcified in their own way. I mean, it has suffered the fate of large institutions in general, and that's been part of the problem as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for a certain level, I mean, I should state here that, you know, as much as I'm trying to kind of provide this synthesis of mm-hmm. a bunch of different things, you know, there's obviously, if you zoom in on any of these, there's a bunch of specific, institution-specific contingent aspects of the story. But, yeah, I mean, you know, all institutions, you know, there's a certain kind of sclerosis that tends to set in. And that's part of what the book is trying to get at and diagnose.
And it goes to the heart of this idea that partly because of the elites, partly because of the way they've been run, that our traditional institutions simply don't work, that the center can't hold and that things continue to fall apart.
Yeah, that's right. And the degree to which we, you know, I think the scary thing to think about or to contemplate is that, you know, the current setup is bound to produce crisis. And part of it's because I think we've moved so far from some of our most basic democratic commitments. There's so much distance between decision makers and people. There's so much outsourcing. There's so much delegating to small groups of people and delegating in a way that we all kind of just basically accept, as opposed to a vision of democratic participation and a vision of democracy that makes one of the key principles that people are equal. I mean, that people that actually, you know, the radical core of democracy and self-governance is that we all have an equal say in what all of us are going to do as a society, as a government. And that's a really radical notion that I think we've gotten away from in a lot of ways.
I mean, you can't help but think of a flawed messenger nonetheless. John Edwards talking about two Americas, you know, mm-hmm. all those many years ago, that he was onto something.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, I think the basic conceptual vision that he was laying out is right on the money.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about it in terms of how we begin to do anything to turn this around.
Yeah, I mean, look, the first thing I think to think is the vast inequality is a real problem and needs to be reined in. And there's lots of ways to do that. I mean, it's not a policy problem. I mean, if we said, you know, if we had a 50% top marginal tax rate and a $10 minimum wage tomorrow, you know, that would really improve things. there are policy prescriptions you can put into place, and they would really improve things. And I think, you know, that's the problem isn't necessarily that we don't have solutions. The problem is where the political power and leverage come from, because it's fundamentally a political problem, because a 50% top marginal tax rate and a $10 minimum wage are actually probably both quite popular in polling, but they're never going to get through Congress for obvious reasons. And so the question is, where is the political power to dislodge those who have the power right now, who benefit from the status quo? And, you know, my kind of proposal in the book is that I think there's a lot of untapped, in some senses, tapped potential of a very radicalized upper middle class. I think the upper middle class, unlike folks who are poor or working class who have spent basically decades very familiar with institutional failure and deindustrialization and stagnation, you know, upper middle class are someone who I think have felt the failed decade as the most keenly as a disruption. Because they're used to institutional performance, they're used to the social contract working, they feel entitled to a certain, to certain opportunities that they feel are now being taken away.
Because they have a foot in both camps, because they can see in both directions.
Right, exactly. I mean, they're close enough to the people that really are winning, and they can see it, and they can feel themselves maybe competing with those people to get their kids into the colleges, or when they're trying to buy a house. So there's a sense that, or you know, you went to law school with someone who now works at a hedge fund and is making, you know, $15 million a year. So I think there's this proximity that makes the structure of distribution at the top all the more potent.
What about this Citizens United era we live in, and the degree to which that makes it so much harder to address these issues? And not to be too bleak about it, the idea that it's always darkest before it turns pitch black. But what if we continue on the path that we're on? We pay, and you point this out, we pay a lot of lip service to education as the great panacea, that's going to be the great equalizer. But it's not.
Yeah, I mean, we increasingly ask so much of the educational system, particularly because we have this, you know, division between a quality of opportunity and a quality of outcome. And we say, you know, we're not a redistributive society. We don't want to achieve a quality of outcome or even reduce inequality of outcome very much. But we do really believe in the level playing field. We believe that everybody should have an equal shot. And the way that we're going to do that is education. But, you know, the educational system is being asked to bear a greater and greater burden for this. And I don't think it can possibly do it. I don't think you can point to a society. I don't think there's an example of a society that pulled this off, that basically had the kind of inequality that we do, but had an educational system that was, you know, so equal and so robust that it was able to erase those advantages and, you know, start afresh with the kids that came into it. And it's frustrating to me that, you know, we have a huge conversation about school reform, right? We have no conversation about child poverty. Like, why are all those kids poor that go to these schools that are bad? And obviously, you know, kids should go to good schools. I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of interesting, you know, difficult and complicated conversations having right now about, you know, improving school performance. But it just happens in an absolute vacuum. It happens in a vacuum in which, you know, the fact that, you know, our school system is incredibly segregated along race lines and socioeconomic lines is just kind of taken as a given.
There is the sense, finally, on both sides that the game is rigged somehow. And in many ways, there's the sense of that because it is, and partly the result of money. How do we begin to battle that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the game being rigged is a phrase that I heard from so many different people, Tea Party folks,
right.
Occupy people, disaffected moderates. Yeah, it expresses this fundamental sense of betrayal. The social contract has been ripped up, or the terms renegotiated without being able to have a say in it. And I think that the, you know, Citizens United is remarkably unpopular as a decision. I think the spectacle of billionaires, you know, essentially playing the role of puppet masters in our elections is offensive to people, and offensive not just to liberals. I think it's generally offensive to people. And I think that, you know, I guess my hope is that the Citizens United, the post-Citizens United era, and the conditions under which the current campaign are being run will provoke some genuine, just democratic backlash, will produce scandal and backlash, because I think that we just fundamentally, we still, you know, left and right, there's still a core democratic commitment to one person, one vote, and the fact that we are all created equal when it comes to making these decisions collectively. And, you know, the Citizens United era is unfolding in such a way that it makes a mockery of that core principle. And I'm hopeful that really does produce some backlash.
Chris Hayes, his book is Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. He's going to be at the Commonwealth Club this evening at 6 p.m. Chris, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.